Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Jason Dole, sitting in for Tim Bruno. Coming up on the show today, hospitals are closing across New York, and many communities don't find out until it's too late. The Local Input for Community Healthcare Act is trying to give the public a voice before those vital services disappear. Gender-affirming care is becoming harder to access, especially for trans youth. President Trump's policies are prompting clinics in New York and PA to scale back services. We talked to regional advocates about the growing trend of trans migration. And legendary singer-songwriter Terry Roach of the iconic trio The Roaches is coming to the Muse in Rosendale for a special concert on Friday. She joins us live this morning. We talk about the River Race returning to the Delaware Youth Center. All that coming up after the latest news from NPR.
Rova Coleman. NPR has learned that Israeli officials believe the U.S. will join its military attack on Iran. President Trump does appear to be moving closer toward Israel. Writing online yesterday, Trump said Iran's supreme leader is a, quote, easy target. The U.S. has not, as yet, joined Israel's attacks on Iran. The U.S. embassy in Israel has been closed since Tuesday. The State Department says it will stay closed for the next several days for security reasons. Meanwhile, the United Kingdom is evacuating some citizens from Israel. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London.
The UK Foreign Office says it's temporarily withdrawing family members of staff at the British Embassy in Tel Aviv and at the British Consulate in Jerusalem. It calls this a precautionary measure amid a, quote, fast-moving situation that poses significant risks. It's also asking any British nationals in Israel or the occupied Palestinian territories to register their presence with the British government.
NPR's Lauren Freyer reporting. An overnight curfew for downtown Los Angeles has now been lifted. It was imposed last week following clashes between authorities and protesters after federal immigration raids. Steve Futterman has more.
Mayor Karen Bass, who imposed the curfew, said tensions here in the downtown area have been reduced. In a written statement, she said the curfew and other crime prevention efforts have been successful in protecting stores, restaurants, businesses, and residential areas. When the curfew first went into effect, L.A. was enduring nightly confrontations, with police at times using non-lethal explosives, tear gas,
Off streets!
And declaring unlawful assemblies. Although the nightly protests and confrontations have essentially ended, there are still some troops in place protecting a number of downtown federal buildings. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported a drop in home building activity. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average soared about 100 points in early trading.
Builders broke ground on fewer housing units in May than they did the month before. The slowdown was all in multifamily housing. Construction of single-family homes actually inched up last month. Permits for future home construction of all types was down in May, however. A survey by the National Association of Home Builders shows builder confidence is also down in the face of tariffs, uncertainty, and elevated mortgage interest rates. Short-term interest rates are expected to hold steady this afternoon when the Federal Reserve wraps up its latest policy meeting. The Fed is waiting to see how the president's trade, tax, and immigration policies play out in the U.S. economy. Scott Horsley, NPR News. Washington.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrials are now up 112 points. This is NPR. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has released a more detailed analysis of the proposed tax cut and spending bill now in the Senate. The CBO says the measure would increase U.S. deficits by $2.8 trillion over the next decade. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and others say the CBO score fails to take into account how much economic growth the bill would create. Conspiracy theorist Alex Jones is facing another lawsuit, this time for allegedly hiding assets from the Sandy Hook families. They won more than $1 billion in damages for defamation. NPR's Tovia Smith reports a federal trustee overseeing the settlement calls Jones' financial dealings, quote, textbook fraud.
Jones has long claimed he didn't have the money to pay the families who sued him after he accused them of faking their children's deaths in 2012. Now, the trustee in Jones' bankruptcy case is trying to prove that Jones at least used to have it, but tried to hide it by giving it to his father, his ex-wife, and his kids' trust. The trustee wants the federal bankruptcy court to undo $5 million worth of last-minute sales and transfers of cars, condos, cash, and a ranch. Lawyers for Jones did not respond to requests for comment. Chris Maddy, attorney for the families, says it's no surprise Jones would lie to hide his assets, but added, quote, he won't get away with it. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
The Florida Panthers have successfully defended their title as NHL champions. They won the Stanley Cup last night, defeating the Edmonton Oilers 5-1 at home. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include AG1, introducing AG1 Next Gen, a daily drink with vitamins, minerals, and probiotics to support overall health. Learn more at drinkag1.com/science.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Jason Dole, I'm in for Tim Bruno. Thank you so much for being here with me this morning. Well, we start with some breaking news. Garnet Health announced a restructuring yesterday that will lay off 42 employees. Garnet also said that it will end outpatient pulmonary rehabilitation services at Garnet Health Medical Center and outpatient diabetes services at Garnet Health Medical Center and Garnet Health Medical Center Catskills due to what the hospital says is, quote, consistent underutilization. Additionally, Garnet Health Medical Center's trauma program will transition from a Level 2 trauma center to a Level 3 trauma center designation to better reflect current utilization, a more sustainable model, and our community's needs. That's from a statement from Garnet Health. What does that transition mean? Well, Level 2 and Level 3 trauma centers both provide care for injured patients, but Level 2 centers offer a broader range of services, are typically more comprehensive, and have 24/7 in-house coverage by general surgeons and specialists, while Level 3 centers may not have those. Level 3 centers may also transfer patients to Level 1 or 2 centers for specialized care beyond their capabilities. And again, Garnet Health Medical Center's announcement saying its trauma program is transitioning to a Level 3 trauma center designation. And we should note that Garnet Health is a financial supporter of Radio Catskill. New York lawmakers have passed a bill aimed at giving communities more say when hospitals plan to shut down or eliminate critical services like maternity care, mental health units, or emergency rooms. Advocates say the lack of transparency and community input in hospital closures has left many New Yorkers, especially in communities of color and rural areas, without reliable access to care. Now all eyes are on Governor Kathy Hochul, who has the final say. Tim Bruno spoke with Lois Utley with Community Voices for Health System Accountability about what the Local Input for Community Healthcare Act would change and why supporters are pushing the governor to sign it into law.
This is a really important bill that will ensure that communities are notified in advance and given an opportunity to comment on plans by their local hospitals to either shut units like maternity or the ER or to shut entirely. All too often, communities are given little or no advance notice when their hospitals are going to downsize or close entirely. And they don't have an opportunity to look at the closure plan to say, hey, that won't protect my access to care. What am I going to do when the hospital closes? So this bill, which of course has now passed both houses of the state legislature, tries to address that by ensuring advance notice and meaningful engagement of the affected community.
You've worked on this issue for many years. What kinds of hospital or service closures prompted the push for this bill in the first place?
Well, across the state, hospitals have been moving to close essential units like the maternity ward, the emergency department, inpatient psychiatric services, or close the hospital entirely. In fact, over the last 25 years, we've seen 54 hospitals closed across the state, including most recently here in New York City, where I'm based, the Mount Sinai Beth Israel Hospital closed after a lot of community protest. We've also seen 10 hospitals that closed their maternity services over the last decade, including in a lot of rural counties around New York. So we're very concerned that this is happening, and we think people who are going to be affected by a hospital downsizing or closing must be given ample advance notice and the opportunity to comment on and be engaged with state officials about how to protect their access to care.
Let's talk a little bit about equity and community impact. Your coalition points to serious equity issues when hospitals close. What does the data show about which communities are losing services and what's at stake?
Yes, there is a very serious issue with these hospital closures that are devastating, of course, to many affected communities. But we've discovered through recent study that communities of color are especially affected. A new study from the Community Service Society found that hospital closures are more prevalent in counties that have significant populations of communities of color. They also, of course, affect rural areas because people there would have to travel further to another county or, you know, sometimes 100 miles to get to another hospital if their local hospital closes.
Can you explain what happens under current law when a hospital plans to close or eliminate services like maternity, emergency, or mental health services? What role does the community play, if any?
Good question. Closings of entire hospitals right now are accomplished through what's called notice to the State Department of Health and by submission of a closure plan, which is reviewed only by State Department of Health staff behind closed doors. There is a requirement under informal guidance from the department for there to be a community meeting. And at this community meeting, the hospital CEO is supposed to answer questions from the community. But what we've seen in practice is that since the hospital it wants to close is also holding the community meeting, these meetings are very tightly controlled, and it doesn't appear to local residents that hospital officials are at all interested in what they have to say about the plan. The hospital officials just want to get through the community meeting to say they had one. We don't think that's right. We think the State Department of Health should be holding the meeting. That way there'd be neutrality in who's running the meeting, and people would feel more encouraged and welcomed in speaking out to say things like, my nearest hospital is too far away for me to get to. I don't have a car. I'm disabled. I'm frail and elderly. I'm pregnant. I can't go that far to the next hospital.
There's been concern about a lack of transparency and accountability in how these decisions are made. What are the current blind spots, and how does the bill now address them?
Well, current law on hospital closures is really terrible. It actually only requires a public hearing 30 days after the hospital closes. Fortunately, the State Department of Health did put some guidance out that requires an advance public hearing, that, as I said, it's not very welcoming to community residents who would be affected. The problem then is that the decision-making all happens behind closed doors at the State Department of Health. You know, we certainly think Department of Health folks are expert and they try to do the best for the community, but that's not a transparent process. Governor Hochul has pledged to make state government more transparent to New Yorkers. And this is the opposite of that. So we think what should be required is that the decisions about it be made in public at a meeting of the State Public Health and Health Planning Council, at which people from the community can appear and give testimony. The Public Health and Health Planning Council has many experts in public health, health equity, health administration, and we would welcome their input and discussion about hospital closure plans. Unfortunately, that's just not happening now with hospital closures.
The bill passed with support from the legislature. As we mentioned, it's on the governor's desk. How soon does she need to act?
Well, Governor Hochul doesn't have to act right away, although we wish she would. Last year, the same bill passed the state legislature, and she waited until the very end of the year, mid-December, to decide to veto it. We thought that was unacceptable. We want to engage her much earlier this year. We are launching a campaign to urge Governor Hochul to follow through on her promise to make state government more transparent by signing this bill and ensuring ample public notice and meaningful engagement of communities when their hospitals want to close or downsize.
Were there any changes made from last year to this year in order to help make that bill more veto-proof?
We tried to engage the State Department of Health early on this year in discussion about what changes they would want to see to the bill. I reached out to them in February. Unfortunately, we didn't have a meeting with them until just last week. So there really wasn't time to change the bill. It sailed through both houses of the state legislature again. We do look forward to the opportunity, we hope, to speak with the governor's office and again with the State Department of Health about what changes they would need to see, if any, so that the governor can see her way to signing it this year.
Do you know why or reasons given for the veto last time?
Well, and not surprisingly, the state hospital associations have opposed this bill. They claim it makes the process too long, it's too much red tape, they need to be able to close quickly. We understand all those things, but this is about people's access to health care in their own community. We think we as New Yorkers need to take the time to do this the right way, to get all the needed public input, and to really think creatively about what strategies we could use to keep hospitals open, to maintain services, or if needed, come up with alternative strategies to get people the health care they need.
Governor Hochul running for re-election next year as New York's governor. Do you think politics will come into play whether she signs this bill or not?
Well, I hope the kind of politics that will matter is Governor Hochul listening to communities, listening to communities who have experienced the loss of their hospitals. Would invite her to come to Lower Manhattan and listen to people who have now lost Beth Israel Medical Center. Some of us who live here in the city have been surveying Lower Manhattan residents, and we've heard some scary things. One man who used to go to Beth Israel Medical Center ended up at Bellevue, and he was in the ER for 8 days because there were no beds available in the hospital. It was just way overcrowded. And yet Bellevue has been cited as the nearest alternative hospital for people who lost Beth Israel.
How can concerned New Yorkers weigh in on this issue?
Well, we're going to have many opportunities available through social media and other means of outreach for people to email the governor, call the governor's office, urge her to do the right thing this year. Listen to those of us who have been so affected by loss of access to health care and ensure that we have a voice. What this really is about is giving communities a say and the future of the healthcare in their community.
That's Lois Utley with Community Voices for Health System Accountability. Lois, thank you for joining us this morning.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We'll take a quick break. When we come back, the growing trend of transmigration in response to Trump administration policies. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new releases, film festivals, nostalgic screenings, live music events, and more. Information and schedule at thecalicoontheater.com.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Izar, host of Farm & Country. This week, we sit down with some of your local favorite farmers. We'll hear from Brenda Miller from Bobolink Farm on the impacts of federal funding losses and community. And we'll also hear from Brian Fox of the Wayne County Farmers Market on this summer's market and how he got inspired to grow his own food. All of that and Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report this week on Farm & Country, Saturday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Jason Dole. Well, the LGBTQ plus community's access to gender-affirming care is only becoming more precarious under President Trump. In January, Trump signed an executive order calling for governmental agencies to ensure that medical institutions receiving any federal research or education grants, quote, end the chemical and surgical mutilation, end quote, of people under 19. The order has not been officially implemented. Multiple lawsuits have been filed against the Trump administration to block its enforcement, but many health care providers in both New York and Pennsylvania have already scaled back their gender-affirming care services as a preemptive measure. As a result, the LGBTQ plus community is witnessing an influx in what could be referred to as transmigration, in which trans people are having to travel greater distances to other cities, counties, and even entirely new states to access life-saving health care. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim spoke with Corinne Goodwin, Executive Director of Eastern PA Trans Equity Project, and Charlie Sullivan, Director of Programs and Services at the Hudson Valley LGBTQ Plus Center. Here's Corinne Goodwin.
Have you been seeing or just hearing of this kind of migration of trans people from, you know, cities and counties with the lack of gender-affirming care, healthcare services, which I think is especially an issue in Pennsylvania, because we're seeing so many of these huge health networks completely pause gender-affirming care, and they serve a lot of people.
First is that, you know, over 20 states have banned gender-affirming health care for minors. So Tennessee and Ohio and West Virginia and, you know, many, you know, Arkansas, Texas, you know, you kind of name a red state and you'll probably find a ban on trans health care for minors and in some cases for adults. So we are seeing where people will relocate entire states. So we have a person who comes to some of our support groups. They migrated from Florida to Pennsylvania so they could get access to health care. We're seeing people who might live in Tennessee who have family, for example, in Pennsylvania or New York or New Jersey, and they will travel, stay with family for a week or two while their child or while they access gender-affirming health care in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, or another affirming state. So we're seeing that kind of migration. We're also seeing in Pennsylvania itself, for example, where we've already had an issue of, you know, if you live in a very rural part of the state, so let's say Wayne or Pike County, up near the Catskills, right? You know, you may already have had to drive an hour and a half or 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours, to access gender-affirming health care in a face-to-face environment. This has just made that even worse, because now people who maybe lived in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, right in the middle of the state, right where both UMPC and Penn State Health have large hospitals and had practitioners providing this type of care, they now have to travel to Philadelphia, or Penn State Health has been recommending people travel to Baltimore, to Johns Hopkins. You know, and if you live in the northern part of the state, you might have to drive into New York City.
This comes as three major health networks in PA, including the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, Penn State Health, and Penn Medicine, have all either partially or completely discontinued gender-affirming care services for both old and new patients under 19. which depends on whether the treatment is pharmacological, such as puberty blockers, or surgical, like TOP surgery. Charlie Solidum, the Director of Programs and Services at the Hudson Valley LGBTQ+ Center, explained that in addition to withdrawing gender-affirming care, clinics in the Hudson Valley who want to continue providing these services are having to neutralize their language, erasing any information on their websites related to this care to maintain federal funding. Sullivan himself is a trans man who had seen the increase in access to gender-affirming care with the passage of the Affordable Care Act back in 2010, which prohibits healthcare providers and insurers from discriminating on the basis of gender identity and opened the door for gender-affirming care to be reimbursed by insurance. I wanted to ask, how has this executive order, you know, been affecting the trans community, specifically in the Hudson Valley, including those, you know, who might attend or depend on the center that you are one of the directors of?
The gender affirming care page of one of the local clinics here, in the days following that executive order, take down their entire website about gender affirming care. And it was just an error 404 for many days after that, because, you know, it's not that they're going to necessarily stop providing those services, but they have to be careful about their language because of that threat of having to lose that funding. So seeing that, you know, because of this heightened scrutiny on the transgender community, providers have been more neutral about their coding of certain procedures of, you know, say, for example, if a patient previously were to be receiving hormone care under the diagnosis of gender identity disorder or gender dysphoria, we're seeing providers sort of shift that language and instead codify the diagnosis as like an unspecified endocrine disorder, something like that, where it doesn't necessarily flag the patient as transgender. So, you know, we are seeing that there are less providers and also that the resources are harder to find because of having to do this sort of dance with the language that, you know, if providers aren't willing to overtly declare that they are providing gender affirming care, then you have to think about, well, how do people find their doctors even then, you know, how do you know? And so we're seeing that there's like a little bit more of a, you know, underground whisper network of referrals of people trying to get, you know, trying to find out who is providing this care because it's going to be less outwardly visible.
But for the trans community in the United States, this migration is far from easy. In addition to transportation costs, they cannot even be sure that their insurance plan covers care in a different state.
So it isn't, you know, just people moving, but it's also people having this amazing inconvenience and expense.
I mean, access has been hard already for trans people, trans youth. You mentioned the unevenness in care, especially for rural communities in counties in Pennsylvania, where they were already having to drive like hours to access. And so with this like increased migration we are seeing because of these attacks on hospitals, I'm wondering who really is able to migrate this far. And I say that because we know like within the queer community, there is diversity, strong diversity in terms of race, in terms of class and things like that. And so who is able to go these long distances to pay for transportation in that way?
It's important to kind of set as a baseline that unemployment amongst transgender people runs at 4 to 5 times the national average. So right now, when, you know, we're talking about an unemployment rate of around 4% for the country as a whole, it's over 16% for transgender individuals. So that, number one, creates a level of poverty. Another way to look at it is to use what's called the ALICE line. So ALICE stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Yet Employed. In other words, you are a member of the working poor, and you are probably one blown transmission away from some form of financial disaster, right? If you get sick, you may not be able to pay your rent this month. You know, a lot of folks are in this community are gig workers and so on. In our service area, so the counties that we serve, 42 counties in the state of Pennsylvania, 46%, almost half of transgender people, live at or below the ALIS line. So if you are a member of that, you know, ALIS community where you are working paycheck to paycheck, do you have the extra money to allow you to drive 2, 3, or 4 or more hours for treatment, to pay for a hotel room to get that treatment? The answer is probably not. So we know that we have people who are skipping their care, rationing their care to try to overcome this.
In addition, Solidum said that the overlap of marginalizations that trans people of color specifically face in terms of not only unemployment, but also housing instability and food security further exacerbates this issue. Although nonprofits like Rainbow Railroad, which is based in Canada and the United States, have done organizing focused on helping queer people facing persecution, quote, get to safety, the impact of Trump's executive order is reverberating through whole communities. Into your work a little bit, you know, a huge part of your work has been dismantling kind of structural barriers to services for marginalized communities, specifically queer people of color. And I wanted to ask if you can kind of go into the kinds of structural barriers that you've seen.
Structurally, I think that dealing with the, you know, not only the marginalization of being a trans person, but being a trans person of color and having that also compound, you know, things like employment and things like food and housing access, like those all really have an impact on the ways that people are able to engage with their medical care, you know, because if you are unhoused, you know, you one, don't have a place to store your medications, and two, you know, having your care of your body and your medical care not necessarily be your highest priority. And you're seeing these people who are multiply marginalized. You have to think about, like, where in that model does someone's care and healthcare access fall into their overall, you know, level of concern about the things in their lives?
With that being said, migration is not a new issue for trans people who have historically had to navigate a lack of options for gender-affirming care, especially in New York and Pennsylvania's more rural areas that are under-resourced, Solidum said.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the Mid-Hudson Valley, most people are going to the city, although there are some resources in, you know, sort of like the Finger Lakes region or for affirming care. I think that, you know, probably the closest places to get care would be in the city from here. Again, there's sort of like this whisper network of folks that, you know, do provide care in the Hudson Valley region. It's just harder to find. But, you know, speaking personally, up until I'd say last year, I was traveling to the city myself to get my testosterone, as I am on a certain delivery method known as Testopel. It's a hormonal implant, and that's something that's been very difficult to access up here. So every 3 months I would have to go down to the city just to, you know, have my entire day be about going to this one medical appointment, then, you know, having to come home. Luckily, I've been able to find a provider that can do that for me up here in the Hudson Valley region. But, you know, according to my primary care provider, that's really, you know, the people who are accessing that specific method of hormone delivery, like, you can count on like one hand, basically.
In addition to emphasizing the life-saving nature of gender-affirming care for trans youth in terms of reducing depression and suicide ideation by 60% and 73% respectively, which is found by a study that was conducted during the first Trump administration, Goodwin said she wanted to push back against the sensationalized misconception that trans youth have always had unrestrained access to services like hormones or puberty blockers.
There's this narrative out there that young people or adults like myself can just sort of walk in and say, give me hormones, right? Or give me hormone blockers, or give me surgery. The truth is that there is a tremendous amount of gatekeeping, and there's a lot of hurdles you have to overcome. So, in most cases, you have to see at least one, often two therapists who will provide a letter stating that you have a diagnosis of gender dysphoria before you can get access to either hormones or surgical care. Then you have to have find a healthcare provider who will provide that care. In many cases, you have to wait months and months for an appointment to see that healthcare provider. Then you have to get approval from your insurance company to provide the care, right? So it's not like you just walk in. I mean, it can take a year, 2 years, or even more, especially with young people, to get access to this care.
For the healthcare providers who openly maintain their gender-affirming care services, Saladin noted that they are feeling the strain of an influx of patients as more people pivot to these institutions.
The higher volume of patients that these providers are seeing, you're going to see longer wait times. You're going to see it being harder to get appointments in general, harder to get on that provider's schedule because trans-affirming providers are very much in demand.
Trans people and their loved ones are still actively searching for resources, with Goodwin describing a jump in calls to the project in search of support in the past year.
Historically, so if we go back, you know, a year ago, our organization on any one given day would typically see maybe a half a dozen people reach out to us for some need, right? That could have been a referral to a healthcare provider, could have been interest in our support groups, it could have been seeking financial assistance or other things. The day after the election, we had 78 people reach out to us. Things have continued at this elevated level. So all through last fall and into the holiday season, we were getting 20 plus people reaching out to us. The day after the inauguration, we had over 60 people reach out to us, all of them in fear. And one of the things that has really shifted over the past few weeks, as these healthcare providers have stopped providing care, is the number of parents calling us, you know, moms calling us in tears, worried about their kids' mental health as they, you know, get their health care refused.
In addition to the Whisper Network he mentioned, Saladin, who has a background as a peer outreach worker in New York City, said that mutual aid by and for the trans community in Hudson Valley have been strong in filling that gap. Get your bio. You mentioned how you kind of began your career in more direct services as a peer outreach worker. You know, you did things like hand out condoms to people at Christopher Street Pier in New York City. And I was wondering, do you think we're going to or already seeing an increase in these more community-based mutual aid-esque initiatives?
I mean, that's something that is really strength of the Hudson Valley region right now, is that there is a lot of trans mutual aid networks and being developed and being established and doing a lot of really great work to support community members. Thinking of projects like Closet of the Hudson Valley. I'm thinking of projects like Trans Joy Revolution. These are both organizations that are focused strictly on community building and, you know, sharing resources that way. Because, yeah, when we do not have support from the government, you know, all we really have is each other. So building community and building those structures to sustain us outside of the support from the state, I think, you know, is where the movement is going.
I just spoke with Charlie Saladin of the Hudson Valley LGBTQ Plus Center and Corinne Goodwin of the Eastern PA Trans Equity Project on the issue of trans migration and how it's impacting New York and Pennsylvania. In Liberty, I'm Julie Kim for Radio Catskill.
And thank you so much, Julie Kim. This is Radio Catskill. I'm Jason Dole. And coming up this Friday, the Muse in Rosendale, New York, is celebrating its one-year anniversary, and they're doing it with a special concert featuring legendary singer-songwriter Terry Roach, co-founder of the iconic trio The Roaches, known for her deeply personal songwriting, signature guitar work, and decades of collaboration with a wide range of artists. Terry will be joined by special guests Lisa and Lori Brigantino, multi-instrumentalist sister duo praised for their tight harmonies and genre-blending performances, And Terry Roach is joining us live now to talk to us about this. Terry, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, well, thank you, Jason, for having me on your show.
Well, let's start by talking about this performance on Friday at the Muse, Rosendale. How did this show with Lisa and Lori Brigantino come together, and what can folks expect on Friday?
Well, actually, a guitar student of mine, Elizabeth Cornell, she's a student of mine for many years, she contacted me and said that she had some friends who had this club up in Rosendale and would be very interested in talking to me about playing there. So that's where the seed of this came up. All and right. then, but the show is going to be this, Lisa and Lori. Lisa and Lori and I have worked together a lot. And 2 weeks ago, we did a version of the show that you're going to see on Friday. And the way it works is that they sing first, the two of them. And of course, they have that wonderful sister blend and some great songs. And then I come and I play by myself. And then we have a short break, I think. And then all three of us raise hell.
That's great.
And that's, yeah, and that's, so it's a show in three parts.
Okay, great. So, and this is all to celebrate the 1 year anniversary of this venue, the Muse. I don't know if you've played there before, but I mean, what do you think that you're going to be there to help mark this milestone for a real community focused art space?
Well, I'm really honored. You know, I didn't know about the Muse, but the more I hear about it and have read about it, the more I'm really honored to be participating in their 1 year anniversary, and I congratulate them on keeping it going. It's a great idea to have a community venue where, you know, especially now when the arts are kind of under fire in our country.
Yeah. And, you know, a good way to respond to that fire is locally with so many issues. I mean, that's a big part of what we're doing here, is just talking to the community about what's happening in the community. It's what we've always done, but I think it's more important now than ever. Yeah.
I agree with you. In fact, that I would say is the single most positive thing that's coming out of what's happening in our country, is that communities on the local level are really getting together with each other. And that's where the power is.
You know, and I love shows where, I mean, there's plenty of shows where you have, you know, two great acts on the bill, but I love a show where you're going to do what you're talking about doing, where one act plays, the other act plays, and then everybody kind of comes together. And that's always a really cool thing to see. Lisa and Lori are really known for their, you know, rich harmonies as well as their instrumental versatility. How do your voices and musical sensibilities mix on stage?
Well, you have to come to the show and hear.
Okay. <That's
laughs> to
fair
answer,
answer
that. You got to tell me how it works. But, no, we actually work together very well. I love working with both of them. They have great ears for harmony, and we can, you know, just if something goes differently than we thought it was going to go, we just kind of, you know, glance at each other and we seem to understand how to adjust, which is not the case with everybody. You know, it's harmony singing is a very particular thing, which of course I come out of a long tradition of that with my own family.
Yeah.
So it's something I love to do with them as well.
Well, and you know, harmony singing is one thing, but then the magic that happens when you're harmony singing with siblings. I mean, the musical world's kind of reacting to the passing of Brian Wilson last week, and it's reminding people a lot about those, you know, the harmonies that those brothers and cousin had. And, you know, you've got Lisa and Lori Brigantino, great harmonies, and their sisters. You have a long experience with sibling harmonies. I mean, it always seems like there's an extra something when siblings sing like that.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm glad you brought up Brian Wilson, since I've, like so many other people, been completely immersed in his music since hearing that he passed. And the other night I sat down and listened from the beginning to the end of Pet Sounds, which I had not done before, really. Just, I know a lot of the songs, but listening to the whole thing in sequence like that, it was just so moving. I mean, to realize what he had done musically.
Let's talk about you. Your most recent album, I think, just came out last year. Was Inner Adult?
Yes.
It says here that you recorded it in one take on the island of St. John. Is that right? Doing it in one take? What, and if so, what inspired yes. such a stripped down in the moment approach?
Well, the first thing that inspired it was that I was not thinking that I was making an album. I realized that I had written about 13 songs over the past year or two, and I just wanted to hear them. You know, I thought, oh, you know, because I didn't sit around and play them for myself, and I wasn't really out there performing much, you know, so I thought, I just want to hear what they sound like. So I went into Coral Star Studios, which is the only studio, recording studio on St. John, and with Alan Clapp, whose studio it is. And I just said, Alan, I just want to record these songs and just not stop in between them. I just want to hear what they are. And when I listened to them, I was like a fan, you know. I thought, wow, this is really great. I like this. And then I thought, I'm going to put this out just as it is.
Wow, it sounds like you sat down to make some demos, and then you heard the demos, and you're like, well, this is good enough the way it is.
Well, yeah, and I wouldn't even say good enough, because there are places in it, you know, where I can hear myself kind of stumble over a word or a guitar thing or something, and I like that. You know what I mean? Like, I miss that in records. A lot of times everything is perfected, you know? And so I really like the sound of something that's not perfected. I think I'm reacting against how mechanical things have become. You know, machines are doing it instead of people. Yeah. So my inner adult was, I thought, you know, wow, this is really interesting to me as a listener.
And, you know, in a world where technology is increasingly enabling greater and greater, quote unquote, perfection, it's a little bit of rebellion to go ahead and say, you know what, we don't need to be that perfect.
Yes, exactly. And also, I have nothing against technology. You know, it's like, it's not my medium, really. You know, I'm a singer and guitar player primarily, and songwriter. And I think the ideas in the songs are really interesting, and I really enjoyed, you know, crafting the melodies and the guitar parts and stuff.
And you can just talk briefly about the name, Inner Adult. When did that come in?
Yeah, that kind of, you know, it's funny. I'm not sure when. A lot of ideas come up in your mind, and you don't necessarily mark down the date, like, oh, this is the day I thought of this, you know. What I mean?
Yeah.
But I know that there's a lot of talk about your inner child, you know, healing your inner child, you know. Well, I was thinking about that whole idea, how, like, the songs in many ways are very healing for me. And but I thought, I'm not a child. I'm 72 years old. You know, and then I thought, inner adult, you know, so that's where it came from.
What do you think, you know, like you say, you've been doing this for a while, you've been, you know, more than 50 years in music. What keeps you creatively motivated? And along those lines, what advice would you give to newer artists who are just starting out and trying to find their voice?
Oh, that's a very good question. And thank you for asking me that, because at this point, I'm kind of a, you know, an elder, and I do have advice for younger people. I was talking to someone yesterday, and she's a painter,
and she's been going through a difficult time, and she was talking about how her art, it's almost like you can't not do your art. You know, and that's how kind of you know whether you're an artist or not. You can't not do it. It just comes up. Like even for me with this new record, it's like I wasn't asked to do this. I don't have a manager and gigs anymore, you know. And yet here's 13 songs showed up. So I trace it, in my case, to actually my parents, especially my mother, who all her life she wrote poetry and stories and stuff. And she would encourage us, if you got in trouble, you know, she'd say, go up to your room and draw a picture, you know, or write a song. Like these were ways of dealing with your mind when you got in trouble with yourself. Like the arts were very important to my parents. And we grew up in that kind of a environment was like, just go do something and, you know, do your art rather than I see a lot of younger people who are thinking about, well, how do I get a manager or where can I get a gig? You know, and my feeling is you put yourself into the work and someone is going to notice that.
Especially if the work is that integral to your life. You know, it's part of how you function in the world,
yes.
How you deal with your brain, as you were saying. Wow, that's really great.
That's the gift you have to offer. And it's different from the gift that Brian Wilson had to offer or that, you know, Taylor Swift has to offer. It's like your gift, a lot of it is finding your authentic voice, I think. And anyone at any age can do that.
We've been talking to Terry Roach, who will be performing at the one-year anniversary concert at The Muse Rosendale this coming Friday with Lisa and Lori Brigantino. Terry, thank you for taking the time to talk to us this morning.
Well, thank you for asking me to do this, Jason. And I hope everybody has a good time at the show. I think you will. And
all right.
Good luck to everyone.
Thank you so much. And there's more information about this concert at themuserosendale.org. And that's what's going on here. We have one more interview to do before we leave for today. And join me live in the studio right now here on Radio Chatskill. We're going to talk about the River Race because the River Race is back this summer at the Delaware Youth Center, bringing runners, walkers, and the community together along the Delaware River in Sullivan County. Joining us now, it's Edward Vandershans. Edward, did I say your name correctly?
You certainly did. Good morning, Jason. How are you?
Good, good. Edward, so let's just start with the big picture. This is the 27th annual Delaware Youth Center River Race. Can you give us an overview of the event, what it's going to look like, and how it's changed possibly over the years?
Yes, certainly. So this is the first year that I've been the race director of the River Run. And as you said, it's the 27th annual event, so it's been going for quite some time. We have a 5K event and a 10K event, and we expect about 400 runners to be taking part this year from the local community and hopefully from people outside the community. On top of the race, we also have a virtual event, the Gary A. Wing-Lovitz event. So for runners that can't participate on the day, they can also sign up online and participate virtually.
And with more than 400 runners, I mean, this is a race for a variety of folks and of ages and abilities?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. We have everybody from competitive runners taking part. We have a certified distance for each of the two races, the 5K and the 10K. So if you're a competitive runner, you can clock an official time. And we have everybody competing all the way from joggers to fun runners, walkers. And if you're going to be bringing your youngster in a stroller, you can also join along at the back of the race with your stroller.
Stroll along. The course is known for its beauty. Can you talk a little bit about the route that goes along the Delaware River and what runners and walkers think of it?
Sure. So the course starts but just by the Delaware Youth Centre in on Main Street in Callicoon. It goes through the town and then hits River Road, where it goes along for about 5K before circling all the way back into town for the finish. And the finish line is basically at the post office in Callicoon, which I'm sure many people know very well.
And on top of there being different distances you talk about, there's different start times as well?
Yeah, so the faster runners are due to start at 8:15. That's when the first gun goes. And then the sort of the slightly slower runners or fun runners can start at 8:18, so just behind. And then the strollers and walkers will start 3 minutes later at 8:21. So we just stagger the runners so that there's not a traffic jam for the 400 people competing.
Right, right. Just stagger it. You have like an even amount of people going along.
Correct.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I will add that the course is a closed course. So we've got help from the Callicoon Fire Department and the Sullivan County Sheriff's Office. They close the course for the day. So it's traffic free. It's a beautiful course along the river there. Obviously, you can see eagles and so forth that nest along the river there. And we hope that everybody that comes has an enjoyable day.
Yeah, and for the folks that aren't actually going to participate but come and observe, what is there for them? I know is there a ceremony at the end and things like that?
Yeah, so the town has been obviously very supportive of the Delaware Youth Centre for many, many years, and a lot of the businesses there are sponsors of the event. So for people that come to watch their family and friends run, there's many cafes, many restaurants, and we'd hope that people that come to support their friends would also come and support the restaurants and local businesses that support the Delaware Youth Centre throughout the year, and hopefully enjoy their services too.
Yeah, so this is a fundraiser for the youth center, right? Every dollar goes back to the Delaware Youth Center. Can you talk about the youth center's place in the town and the importance of supporting it?
Yes, certainly. So the youth center as a whole supports not just the Callicoon community, but also for many people in the surrounding area. So it's a very important community focal point. This race is historically the biggest fundraiser for the community Youth Centre. This year we're looking to raise about $50,000, and that's generated not only through the race entries, but we also have sponsors that support the event, and we've currently got about 50 sponsors. And we also have a raffle which people can partake in, and we have a number of local community organisations that have donated prizes to that, such as Bethel Woods, Villa Roma, and so forth. Tickets can be found on our website, just the same as race entries.
Yeah, and that's the last thing I wanted to ask you is before we go, how do people register?
So on www.delawareyouthcentre.org, there's a link there to the river race. You can sign up online and also buy raffle tickets online. It's a very easy process. And for people that are running, they can pick up their race numbers either the morning of the race, or to avoid the crush, they can pick up their numbers the day before on Saturday the 19th, and that's between the hours of 1 and 4. So just to reiterate, the race is actually on the Sunday the 20th.
Coming up on Sunday the 20th, and again, that's DelawareYouthCenter.org, DelawareYouthCenter.org. We've been talking to Edward Vandershans. Thank you so much for coming out in person to tell us about it.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for having me here. Bye-bye.
So that's about it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I want to thank you so much for being here with me. I'm Jason Dolben, filling in for Tim Bruno. And Tim will be back with you tomorrow. Tomorrow, June 19th, is Juneteenth. Some things that are happening around the community. Tomorrow night, Farm Arts Collective is holding their annual Juneteenth event with Radio Catskill's Janice Adams participating. And coming up tonight, there's Echoes of Harlem, a Juneteenth tribute to Langston Hughes with Oliver King and the Blue Hearts Jazz Quartet. So jazz music and spoken word. And that's at HPAC, HPACNY.org tonight. This is Radio Catskill. We got local news, culture, and NPR. And thank you again so much for being here with us. This morning, we've got On Point coming up next. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, NACL.org. And from listeners like you.
WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill. Listen local.